It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Well, good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to the 104th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. They include the 176th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you read the columns, enjoy them, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And then John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online daily newspaper at my web home. Try and subscribe. Only one email per day. And the web home is www.johnmack13.com. I'm excited about the upcoming series of guests: mystery writer Frank Hickey, computer scientist and author Peter Denning, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hedrick Smith, and saloon owner and philanthropist Peter Walsh. I hope the audience for this show will catch the upcoming one as well. And now to this show, the 104th in the series. Callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the end of the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is journalist, television producer, foreign correspondent, speechwriter, and college professor Karen DeWitt. Well, that's a lot to cover, so let's get to it. So good evening, Karen, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on, John. You're working on Labor Day weekend, so you never take a break.
No, I don't. Okay, the thought at the beginning, where exactly did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, when it was still an industrial center. It's the home of the Wright brothers and of Paul Laurence Dunbar, the poet. They went to school together, so they knew one another. So an African-American poet and two white guys who ran a bicycle shop in Dayton, Ohio. That's what we're known for, but also for a lot of manufacturing companies. So NCR, National Register Company, early pre-computers, and Firestone, all those kinds of things. I grew up there, went to a local grade schools, and then to a Catholic girls' school there.
It's National Chess Register. It was in the news about 20 years ago where there was a hostile takeover by AT&T, and all of the local politicians and the congresspeople wanted there to be an investigation, monopoly investigation, and in the end AT&T took it. It didn't work out at all, and they wound up spinning it back off, and they almost destroyed NCR's business. Dayton University is also there, isn't it?
Right, University of Dayton, another Catholic institution. It's a German Catholic town historically, and a town that was almost like the one in Texas. It was one of the first two towns to have city manager-type government because of floods, the Galveston flood and the flood in Dayton, Ohio in the 19-teens. Were both floods that turned over mayors who had all the power and turned it over to city councils.
Were you active in journalism at high school? Was it the school paper or anything like that?
Yeah, I wrote for the school paper, and I wrote mostly poetry, which seems funny nowadays, but I wrote poetry for the school paper and covered stories for the school paper.
And
but I was
college.
Really at that time thinking more about art and music. I played violin when I was in high school.
Oh, were you talented? Were you good?
I got good marks on it when I played for my little seminar, and I was very lucky in that the nun who was my teacher, was an FFV, a First Family of Virginia. I don't know what her real name was, but I played my seminar piece on a Strad that she had, a Stradivarius.
Wow. Did you keep it up?
No, I didn't keep it up. No, I didn't keep it up once I went to college.
And then college, where, how did you pick it, and what was your major? And did you write there?
I did write there. I ended up at Miami University of Ohio, which is not where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to Antioch College. I got accepted at Vassar and Oberlin, both of which my parents thought was too expensive. And Antioch was 5 years. I wanted to go there because it was a five-year program. It was work study. So since I was from Ohio and my father had gotten his master's at Miami University, I ended up going to Miami University. And I was just recently there because I was there in the summer of 64 when the Cheney, Swerner, and I can't think of the other guy's name, were training in Oxford, Ohio. They left on a Friday night, and they were killed on Sunday in Mississippi. And so I was there for 1964, sort of the civil rights movement in the 1960s last fall, which was very interesting because I hadn't been back to the college since I graduated.
Was the college the football power when you were there? There was some great football coaches that came out of Miami.
Right.
Paul Brown
and
others,
basketball,
you know,
coaches. What's his name? Who went on to Texas came out of there. But I wasn't really into it. Miami University, when I was there, was very much a fraternity sorority school. I wasn't into sports, so I didn't pay very much attention to that at all. I had read F. Scott Fitzgerald's piece about his early days at Yale, This Side of Paradise, and I was thinking that I was going to go off to school and have serious literary discussions and things like that, and that was not what my college was like at all.
And did you write there?
I did. I wrote for the Miamian, which was the magazine. The first piece I did was on James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, which prompted a lot of blowback. And I wrote for the college newspaper. I was actually a reviewer. I reviewed plays. And I reviewed one play. I can't remember what the play was, but I reviewed it so harshly that I was banned from coming to rehearsals.
Wow. They got you.
I took journalism, of course. There was that one former newspaper man who taught, who taught journalism. And you had to have your copy on his desk by 11 o'clock. This was long before, for some in your audience, there were no cell phones, there were no computers. You actually had to write it on a typewriter and deliver it. And so I was known for sprinting across campus to make sure that it got on 11 o'clock. And I was always on time.
So what did you major in? Was it journalism?
No, I majored in 19th century English Lit and philosophy.
Oh, okay.
Things that were totally, totally useless and actually useful for everything.
So I had started as a philosophy major, and then in checking the New York Times, I saw there were no jobs for philosophers, so I switched to something much more English literature. So we're both in the same boat. So what did you do right after college?
I went to the Peace Corps. I spent 2 years in Ethiopia as a Peace Corps volunteer in a village 220 kilometers outside of the capital of Addis Ababa, and taught English as a second language to grades 7 through 11.
Now, what was the language that they spoke?
The national language at the time was Amharic, which is the language of the Amhara group people, and they were the people who were in power. His Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie was an Amhara. But I lived in a trilingual area of Oromo, Ngala, Garagi, and Amhara. So I speak a little Garaginya and a little Oromo.
You mentioned in your note to me that you speak both Arabic and Amharic, but you also say that you speak bad French. How could How can you master those difficult languages, but a problem, but the language is supposed to be relatively easy?
I don't know. But I think the French are more particular, and the people who are from Ethiopia or the Middle East are so delighted that you speak anything. There's a hot dog guy on the corner not far from where I work, and he's from Egypt, and I just always greet him in Arabic, and it gets a flood of Arabic in return, but also occasionally a free hot dog.
Do you read Arabic, too?
I used to. I don't know. I used to be able to read it, but I can still read Amharic.
Okay. And how many... And then you spent 3 years there, but you went back later to the Middle East. I'll get
to
that.
I spent 2 years in the Peace Corps.
Then
I took about 4 months to travel home through the Middle East, which is when I fell in love with Egypt at the time. I loved being in Egypt and Beirut. And then when I got married... Oh, good. Okay.
Fire my engineer.
Okay. That's all right. If you've got an engineer who's working for you, that's great. He'll probably save us both at some particular point. But I married the Washington Post Mideast correspondent. We opened the Beirut Bureau and got married in 1969. He spoke fluent Arabic, and I met him because I met the late Bob Maynard in New York when I worked for the New York Post, which was owned that time by Dorothy Schiff. And it was a very liberal paper at that time. And Bob asked me what I was doing because he was at the Washington Post. He said, well, what are you doing in New York? I said, well, my job is so new, and I study Arabic at the New School on the weekend. So he went back to the Washington Post and told Jesse, I met this cute black woman reporter up in New York, and she speaks Arabic. And about a couple of weeks later, I had a call from some guy who spoke Arabic to me. He said, I'm coming up to New York to get my Syrian visa. Can we have a drink and dinner, which we did, and I married him several weeks later.
And when you were at the New York Post, which I'm extremely familiar with, James Wexler must have still been the editorial page editor.
Yes, and what's his name? He's famous writer. There was Ted Poston, who was the first African-American reporter to be on a mainstream newspaper and was very famous. Was there for 30 years, and yes, Wexler was there, and
Paul San and
Paul
Jackie
San
Robinson
was my editor. Paul San was my editor. Yeah.
Okay.
He was, and let's see, who else was there? The Mancini brothers, Tony and his brother,
okay,
were there.
I also had great columnists, and Jackie Robinson was one of the first black columnists on a major paper, and he eventually lost his job when he supported Nixon.
Oh, really? Well, he wasn't at the New York Post, but it was a great paper. And
well, he was at the New York Post, but he might have preceded you. Max Lerner was there for years.
I don't remember that name either. I just remember the Mancini brothers, Tony, Paul San, a very famous columnist who was very elegant and suave, just charming. I can't remember his name. Also very liberal, too. It was a liberal paper.
Yeah, it went from a very liberal paper to a very conservative paper.
Exactly.
It changed dramatically. So how long were you at the New York Post?
I was at the New York Post almost 12 months, and then I left and moved to the Middle East when I got married.
Then how long were you in the Middle East then?
I was in the Middle East for 4 years.
And was that one that you were you for sending things back by radio and you were the correspondent?
Yes, I worked for ABC, CBS, and Westinghouse Radio, and I had different names under each one of them. And they were anagrams of my name. Karen Lewis was my name, and it was like Anchor Weissel until they told me that it sounded too Jewish, so I shouldn't do that from the Middle East. And I also work for An-Nahar Reports, which was an Arab economic magazine, the Beirut Daily Star, and Aramco World Magazine, which was a Aramco Oil Company magazine. So I did a lot of reporting while I was there, and including when King Idris was thrown out of Libya by Gaddafi. We went in right after they had thrown him away. And it's a wonderful story involving my ex-husband. At the time, they took down all signs that weren't written in Arabic, and all the restaurants that catered to Westerners had nothing but Arabic restaurants and had nothing but menus in Arabic, and they had like these high school boys to be there standing around to translate for you, sort of putting down foreigners. And so there was this young man standing nearby when we were getting ready to order at this restaurant with this sort of smirk on his face, waiting for my ex-husband to be totally confused by this. And Jesse snapped his fingers and in fluent Arabic ordered the meal, and that was sort of like an amazing experience for all the people in the restaurant that he did that. I thought it was great, sort of slam dunk, or what they would say nowadays, he dropped the mic.
Wow, yes. And then what brought you back here?
Well, his assignment was up, and so I came back to the United States, and I eventually got a job working for a publication called National Journal. It's a heavy-duty policy magazine that was started by a guy named Randy Smith, who had made a lot of money on Wall Street and couldn't figure out what was going on in Washington. Yes, there was Congressional Quarterly, but he wanted sort of more in-depth, so he used his own money and invested in this magazine, and I worked for National Journal for a while, until it was having some financial problems. And on Valentine's Day, 1974, 17 of us were let go, known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
The second St. Valentine's Day Massacre, huh? Now, the National Journal is still around, though, isn't it?
Yes, it was bought, I think, by... I thought it was bought by the L.A. Times, but I may be wrong. But it was bought from Tony, who sold it to some corporation that owns it now. And, yes, it's still around, and it's still quite a substantive magazine.
And was that when you went into freelancing?
Yeah, I freelanced for, 2 years. Because I remember there were 17 of us sitting around the conference room, and with no jobs suddenly. They were Tony was very generous in that he let us come to the office for several months afterwards, and he gave us all severance, and it was a non-union shop, so that was sort of amazing and very generous on his part. And I remember sitting there, and one guy had actually been hired from the Baltimore Sun like in December and then was cut in February. So he was really devastated, and I remember one man said to me, "Oh, well, you don't have any family, so it's not going to be as difficult for you." And I said, "Excuse me, but when the green tide stops with me, it stops. There's no spouse. There's no honeydew. Can you pick this up?" So I freelanced, and the first thing I did right after that meeting was walk in and call a magazine that I had been freelancing for and ask them if they wanted a piece on how the energy crisis was affecting black businessmen. I had no idea whether it was affecting them or not, but I got an assignment that promised me $800, so I found a lead to do that story. And I just continued doing freelancing, and I didn't have a regular job for 2 years.
Of your career, you wrote for a number of prestigious magazines like National Geographic and others.
Right. That was back when I was back in the United States.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when I came back to the United States. A guy at the Los Angeles Times named Bill Toohey, who is dead now, I think, I said I was going to be looking for a job, and he wrote me 6 letters to somebody at National Geographic, some at Time Magazine. It was very nice. It's sort of introduction. And they weren't hiring at Time. They weren't hiring a lot of places, but National Journal was hiring. And I got an introduction to National Geographic, to the great Frank Shore, who was a very famous explorer and writer at the National Geographic, and I got an assignment from him.
And was that one, did that you got into the Washington Post magazine too, Potomac? Was that later?
I got in the Washington Post magazine. Yeah, all of this was going on at the same time, and Washington had Congress was in charge of the city, and it had its first appointed mayor, and there was an election for the first time. We were going to have an elected mayor, and Clifford Alexander, who had been the Secretary of the Army, was running, and so I did a profile on Clifford Alexander, and I did that piece three times. So anybody out there who's a young writer or even an old writer who is getting rejected, don't take a rejection to heart. Just go back, redo it, and I was really lucky because Shelby Coffee III at the time was the editor of Potomac. He went on to be the executive editor of the Los Angeles Times. But at the time I met him, he was the editor of the Potomac magazine, and I brought the piece in, and he said the first time they'd give me the kill fee, which is about a third of what you would ordinarily get for it. And I said, because I was unemployed, what do I need to do to make this piece acceptable? And he was very generous, because a lot of editors won't do this. He said, well, have you looked at pieces by William Sherrill and things like that? And I had done a very linear piece. In other words, from the moment that I interviewed the guy sort of straight through. And when I looked at these other pieces in the magazine, I saw that I could use fictive elements. That is, I could use some dialogue, conversation. I didn't have to go from first to last. I could start last and turn it around and do the piece in a different way. So I learned a lot. And the second time I brought it in, he said, oh, this is better. And we went through the piece, and we went through the piece almost line by line, which once again is great generosity on his part. And I said, when we were maybe a third of the way through it, I said, the lead is at the last, and I want to do it again. And I did. And he accepted it, and it was the first piece that I had in the Washington Post. And when I brought the piece in, his secretary's name was Debbie. He said, Debbie, go tell accounting to cut a check right now, which is also unusual. So that literally I brought the piece in, he looked at it, and I got paid that day. Wonderful experience. I'm sure that people are having similar experiences now.
Now, was he also the editor that then brought you over into the style section?
Yes. Shelby became the editor of the style section, and which was the style section of the Washington Post was really the first time a section of the paper, which had formerly been the women's section, took on writing political profiles and basically people that not just sort of tease and things like that, but the politics behind all of these things. Sally Quinn was famous when she was there, and Judy Bachrach was another famous writer who now works for the Vanity Fair and does profiles, a lot of really interesting profiles in a couple of books. So it was really quite a powerful division of the Washington Post. So I was really delighted that 6 months after Shelby got there, first he asked me if I, you know, they were going to do a piece, they were going to do little vignettes the night that of the election. And this was when Jimmy Carter was running for president. And he said, where would you like to be on election night? And I said, I'd like to be in a hospital emergency ward. And nothing much was going on, actually, in the hospital emergency ward, but I thought it would be interesting. And they had a radio on with, you know, the latest updates on who was ahead, who was not ahead. And it was very quiet. The doctors and the nurses were, you know, joking and laughing and sort of very low-key. And then suddenly they said, code blue, code blue. We have a code blue, code blue. And they brought in a woman who was having a heart attack. And so everybody left the station where the radio was on and went and did their job, and the woman died. And you could see these people sort of almost like a tide sort of ebbing away. They ebbed away from her as people who were in charge of bodies took her away. And gradually they went back to the station where the radio was on, and at that time they were talking that Jimmy Carter had won. So it made a fabulous sort of scene about the shortness of life and about new things happening at the same time. And that was a little short vignette. There were lots of vignettes, but apparently that impressed Ben Bradley and other people, and so Shelby took me out to lunch and offered me a job.
The style section with the riots, what they went into, sounds like something I was familiar with from New York, the New York magazine section of the Herald Tribune that became a New York magazine with Pete Hamill and Tom Wolfe and Jimmy Breslin and that, where that started
As a matter of fact, when I came to New York, the Herald Tribune was, I think, dead by that time. But it wasn't the New York Times that I wanted to work for. It was the Herald Tribune, which is where I wanted to work for. And I had a colleague at National Journal, Dom Bonifeed, who had worked for the Herald Tribune. I mean, the Herald Tribune had beautiful writers and wonderful stories. It was just sort of the creme de la creme of places you'd want to write for if you had any kind of sort of literary desires.
And then it folded into both the World Telegram and the Journal American, and then that only lasted until the newspaper strike,
and then that fell apart.
So how long were you with the Washington Post?
I was with the Washington Post, it's funny you should say this, because I had been looking around for a job, a regular job, and one of the places I went was the New York Times, Newsweek, Time Magazine. I mean, I sort of knocked on the regular doors, and I didn't get any bites. But once I started at the Washington Post, the first big piece I did was on Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was in charge of, National Security Council.
Right.
And it was a funny interview because Brzezinski walks very fast and talks in paragraphs like he did at Harvard, huge, monstrous paragraphs. And I went to the White House, and my photographer, it was freezing cold day, and Brzezinski said, "You can interview me when I walk from the White House to the Madison Hotel," which was across the street from the Washington Post. And he had such a pace that my pen actually stopped working. I had a tape recorder in my hand, a notebook in my hand, and the pen stopped working, and we did not slow down. So I reached in my bag and found an eyebrow pencil and ended up taking notes with the eyebrow pencil, still going at the same pace. And we were like a troika, you know, my photographer running in front of me and me trying to keep up with Brzezinski and trying to get in another question when this guy, he's used to talking to Harvard students and just sort of lecturing, and he just unwound. He was like a stem winder. So that was my very first piece for the Washington Post style section, and I remember coming in and Shelby saying, "How did it go?" And I said, "I don't know, but it's going to get better." And what I did was call Brzezinski's parents, and he's from Poland. I called his parents in Montreal. That opened up everything. They told me all kinds of details about him, how they'd come from Poland, how he got a map of Poland that he sent to Winston Churchill, how he used to lie on the floor and in the sort of like priests do, you know, spread out and pray the war. It was wonderful. They were just great. And when the peace came out, Brzezinski called me up and he said, "I've gotten up off the floor from prayer, Karen." And he said, "My wife says you've absolutely captured me." So it was wonderful. After that piece came out, I got a call from the deputy at Newsweek who said, "How did we miss you?" I said, "I don't know, because I've been working there on the weekend for you doing publicity for the last 2 years, and I've been sort of knocking on the door, but nobody opened it." So it was wonderful. That also caught the attention of the New York Times, and Jim Wooten and Hedrick Hertzberg, you just mentioned it. He's going to be coming on the program. Rick Smith and Jim Wooten took me out to lunch, and they said, "You should come to work for the New York Times. We're Coke and they're Pepsi." And I said, "Well, I actually knocked on your door in the past, and the Post gave me an opportunity, so I at least have to give them, the courtesy of finishing out my tryout there." But they continued to pursue me after I got there, to the point that, I don't know if you remember Diana McClellan and the Ear Column, but Ben Bradley and Rick had a sort of contretemps with Ben saying, "Keep your hands off my reporters," and And Rick saying, you know, it's a free market kind of thing. So a fun thing.
Well,
wasn't
Newsweek also owned by the Post at that time? Wasn't it
yes,
the same
Newsweek
company?
Yes, Newsweek was owned by the Post at that time. And Mel Elfin was the bureau chief at that time.
So could you have written for both at the same time?
I didn't write for Newsweek. I did public affairs for them, PR for them.
So then how long did you stay with the Post after them telling them to keep their hands off you? How long did you stay there?
I actually worked for the Washington Post for 10 months because the New York Times offered me a big increase in salary. And I was not sophisticated enough to know that you can negotiate by walking into your present employer and saying, look, this is what I'm worth, and can you match it? So I went to the New York Times.
And how long? And what did you do for the Times, and how long were you there?
I was a Washington correspondent for the New York Times, and I was there for 7 years. And I covered politics. SEC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission. I wrote lots of weekend review pieces, did some profiles of people. I did a profile of Mitch Costanza, who was in the Carter administration, several other people beside Brzezinski. I became a sort of a profile person.
Brzezinski still talks like that on Morning Joe when he's on there, too. He still talks fast.
In paragraphs. Yeah, he does.
Right.
He was great. It was a wonderful experience, though.
And what did you have to the Times in journalism?
I went to the Times, and I actually was not happy at the Times. I really was not. It was very interesting because working for the Style section in Shelby had been like paradise. I mean, if anybody has ever had a job which is like paradise, it was like paradise. And in horse racing, they say giving a horse its head. He gave me my head. He allowed me to come up with things. I remember he wanted me to write a piece about chocolate one time, and I said, can I do it like, I can't think of the 1930s author who just boomalaka, boomalaka, chung, chung, chung kind of thing. I wanted to do it the whole thing on chocolate in the same kind of the Congo is the name of the poem, and I can't think of the author, but I wanted to do that, and Shelby said, well, try it. I mean, this is somebody who trusts their workers, and that is so rare. That he sort of was a wonderful, probably my best boss ever, I would say. When I went to the New York Times, it was not the same kind of atmosphere at all. This was in an era also where they referred to everybody as Mr. and Miss and Mrs. I think the Times had just accepted Ms. And I did a piece once, and Molly Ivins was at the paper. She was funny. She was really hysterical because I complained to her about the editors flattening out things, and she, in her wonderful Texas drawl, said, yes, they have an opportunity. They have a way of punching the bubbles out of the champagne. It was wonderful. And she left to go work eventually back in Texas for the magazine, the Texas Monthly, I think. She went to work there. But she was just wonderful. And the Times guy.
Her biography had her very unhappy with the Times.
With the Times, yeah, she was. And that was the time she was leaving shortly after that. So we had beer and chili at her house just as she was leaving, and she wished me good luck. But I was complaining about very much what she was complaining about, which was some sort of flattening out things when you had been hired because you had sort of flair. They took it out, but not completely. And also the editors were superb. We had superb editors at the New York Times. There was one, a woman at the Weekend Review. I can't think of her last name, but Carolyn was so precise. She was like a surgeon that you didn't even know what she had taken out, but she just knew your piece was better. She was not one of those editors that thinks that somehow improving your writing means that they get to rewrite it. She was a real surgeon.
And then where did you go?
Well, I left the New York Times because I thought, and what I still want to do is to write fiction. So I left the New York Times because I wasn't happy, and I thought I had enough money to spend a year working on a novel, which I didn't do because I ended up having a medical problem. And so then I needed to get another job. I was still freelancing, and a colleague of mine from the Washington Post named Joel Dreyfus, who went on to write for Forbes, Fortune magazine, and was their Tokyo correspondent, called me up and he said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm freelancing." And he said, "I was actually Black Entertainment TV had just started, and I'm a cook. I am a really good cook. Bob Johnson had just started BET, and he wanted to have a cooking show. So I ended up doing 2.5 seasons of Karen's Kitchen while I was still freelancing. Joel called and said, "Well, you're freelancing, and what are you going to do after they get all of the shows in the can?" And he said, "There's this new paper called USA Today, and you might want to talk to them about coming to work for them." So I went off and chatted with USA Today, and I had the strangest interview in my life, in which the woman who was interviewing me asked me why I had taken the power chair, and it was just a strange kind of interview. And I thought when I left, oh, well, I guess I won't be going there. But they called me and said they would like me to be a columnist, and so I became a columnist, not the kind of columnist I wanted to be, because I thought a more serious column, but I wrote a column called The Washington Scene for the first 2 years that USA Today was in existence.
You got into management there, too, didn't you?
I did.
With USA Today?
Foreign affairs. I was a foreign correspondent at USA Today, and I ended up being in South Africa for 4.5-5 months. When Mandela had been moved from Robben Island to Polsmoor Prison, and it was quite an exciting time in South Africa. I covered Panama when Noriega was thrown out, and Nicaragua when the Sandinistas were there, and the Nixon administration, the Reagan administration was trying to undermine them. And I was the assistant national editor at USA Today, yeah, which was fun. I just ran across my 1988 journal where I had just come from Guatemala, where I had went to study Spanish, because I figured if I was going to be covering insurrections in places, often when as a foreign correspondent where you're in a place where you don't speak a language, and I didn't speak Spanish, you get a facilitator, and these were often young people, and I thought, I don't want to be talking to some guerrillas with a facilitator who's 17 or 18 years old who says, I don't know who this person is. She says she's a reporter, kind of thing. I thought, if I'm going to get shot or killed, and I had friends who did get killed, particularly in Salvador, at least I want to be able to say, yo soy periodista, you know, I'm a reporter. That's what who I really am. So I took Spanish in Guatemala, intensive course, 4 weeks. All my Spanish is based on these 4 weeks. And when I came back, I became assistant national editor and really enjoyed management, even though I didn't think I would. From looking at this journal, I was asking myself, why do you want to go into management? You know, this is further away from what you really say you want to do, which is to write. But that was what was on my mind. But I actually enjoyed it. I enjoyed being assistant national editor, and I enjoyed the staff that I had. One of the things I said when we were negotiating, and the management said, well, we'd like you to be an assistant national editor. And I said, well, what's the salary going to be, the increase in salary? And they said, well, there's no salary increase. I said, well, there's only money and time. And I said, well, I'm not interested. And they said, well, what could we do to encourage you to take this position? I said, well, there's only money and time. So I said, why don't you double my vacation and I'll take it? And I told them, and I said, I will be taking the vacation. So I think I had 8 weeks of vacation. And
wow.
I told everybody on my staff, I think I had five people on staff. I said, and, you know, when I'm away, you're going to be me. You're going to be the assistant national editor. And one of the people, Ray Tyson, eventually did become the head of that whole team of people. Because I did take vacation. I said, I won't take it all at once, but I'm going to take it. But that was a great learning experience for me for negotiating, because I don't come from the kind of people who negotiate salaries and things like that. I come from, my dad was a school teacher, my mother worked for the government. So the idea that you would say to somebody who was offering you another position, no, I don't want to do that, and particularly since you're not offering any money, and they come back and say, well, what can we do to persuade you? I learned that you can always ask, and they can only say no.
You mentioned Panama de Noriega. Did you ever run across the fellow that wrote the book, Panama, the whole story, Kevin Buckley, in your travels?
No, I didn't. It was,
he didn't,
once again. No, I've never read it.
He had interviewed Noriega while he was in, while Noriega was still in power. Kevin was formerly Newsweek's Vietnam correspondent.
Oh.
And he's my oldest friend. He's married to Lena Horne's daughter, Gail Met Buckley.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, no, I didn't meet him. I got tear gas for the first time in my life, but I didn't meet him, and now that you've mentioned it, I will get the book and read it, because that was a really interesting period.
The book begins like a mystery novel, where this big box is delivered to a home, and they open the box, and it's the head of the man of the house, Chugo Spadafora.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and so Kevin had that whole story, and it got a tremendous review in the New York Times. And I was at the launch party, and the launch party was in the home of Adolph Green what's her name, Newman, his wife, and tremendous. And they did almost no publicity for it. He was on an FM broadcast from Albany and an FM station in Washington, and at the same time, two of my other friends had the book, also from Simon and Schuster. They're both from Simon and Schuster, and then they were advised to get their own publicists, and they were on the Today Show, and there were all sorts of other places, and they did very well. Kevin didn't do as well as he should have with the book. So,
and what's the name of it again?
It was Panama, the whole story.
Panama, the whole story.
I will
definitely get that.
You've also, staying with newspapers before we get to other things, you've also written, as I do, for the West as a Guardian, which is a newspaper that's free to readers, in your case, the Examiner.
Right.
The free newspapers, they're widespread, and the one I write for also has former Congressman Lee Hamilton and critic John Simon writing for it. We see this explosion in the free newspapers, while the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post have gotten physically small. The Washington Post has changed hands, and many of the papers have folded or merged. Can you put this confusion in some perspective for us?
Well, years ago, I taught in J schools, and often I would go as a sort of New York Times person, and the students would say things like, oh, you know Peter Jennings at ABC, because I did know Peter from the Middle East, or you work at the New York Times, I want to grow up. And I would say to them all, because this was the beginning of the Internet, I said, if I was your age, I wouldn't want to work for any of these places. I'd be starting my own business, my own news thing on the Internet. Just like we're talking now, I don't know if you get paid for this, but I just got, I'm interested in religion, and what's his name, Reverend Sterling Spong writes essays once a week. And I just signed up to get his essays, and I could have gotten them for, I can't remember, $16 or something.
John
but
Shelby
anyway.
Spong.
Yeah, Shelby Spong.
John Shelby Spong.
Right, John Shelby.
And I get his essays too.
So I just spend $29 to get this guy's essays, and people say, "Oh well, $29, that's not very much money." But if you get a million people or 10,000 people to do that, you can make your own living. And I just think that the newspapers that exist for me and obviously for you as well. When I came into newspaper business, a lot of the people who had been there professionally had never been to college, and they, and there was it was maybe 10 years earlier when the first group of people who came from colleges started at newspapers. And so all these guys had basically learned, it was on the job. The previous generation had learned it on the job. I mean, I fell in love with newspapers when I was reading about newspaper writers in the 30s and actually in the 30s and 40s when you called in things from telephone booths, and people would do things like take the little socket out of the telephone so that nobody else could file, and while the one person was filing their story, it was the scoop era. And we're just in a different era. Now, where that's going to be, I don't know, because everybody says, well, how do you, the only two things that really make a lot of money on the internet are porn and, what's the other one, pornography and gambling. So I think they have to figure out whatever the way to get paid. And I think it'll probably have to be in micropayments. So you need 1 million people who are going to be paying you 10 cents as opposed to spending $1.50 for a newspaper. Then there's the issue of, okay, where am I going to get my foreign news or really good foreign news? And I read The Guardian right now, but more and more there'll be people all over the world that you can focus in. I mean, one of the things, and you wanted to talk about this, was Facebook. My Facebook page is full of people who are journalists, basically. Journalists, people who are interested in religion, people who are interested in the environment, and often they will post something that I wouldn't have seen in my local newspaper, I wouldn't have seen it in a weekly magazine, because they have drilled down and because that is the particular thing that they're interested in, and now they have opened it up for me. There are people who are photographers. There's a former Time magazine photographer who's very involved with refugees, so I'm hearing things about refugees that I don't hear from anybody. So I think we're in a sea change as far as media goes. I don't know where it's going to be. What are your ideas on it, John?
Well, you asked about the radio show, and the two things that I do that I don't get paid for are the radio show, which is the labor of love. I've always been interested in radio back to the days of the Shadow and the Lone Ranger on the radio. And all the progressions that we saw on the radio, we went from drama to rock and roll and then to talk radio. And every day I publish a newspaper online that I curate from everything from Reason magazine on one side to The Nation on the other and to The Guardian and mm-hmm. others. And I've a bunch of subscribers for that, and it takes me more time than it should because I have the Times of Israel and I have, as I mentioned, The Guardian and other places. Because I enjoy that. I'm the news junkie and the newspaper junkie. I don't know where it's going. I know that many of the magazines that I used to write for, I'm a technologist and I wrote for Computer Shopper and for InfoWorld and for PC Magazine, they're all online now, the transition. But they don't have the audience that they used to. The Computer Shopper and PC Magazine, they were the financial foundations of Ziff Davis. And that's not there anymore. So it's a changing world that I'm not sure where it's going. I just wanted to be part of the action.
Well, I think you're smart because actually when I saw this your radio show and you also write for Salon and you have the daily newspaper, I thought, I could do this. I might want to do this. And you're talking about radio dramas. I don't watch television at all. It's not that I have anything against it. It's just I'm more of a reader. But I do love radio, and I love radio dramas. So now I go to bed with my tablet in the evening, and I listen to BBC radio dramas, radio mysteries, because I really like radio mysteries. And I thought, and there was a radio program done. It was called Miette's Bedtime Stories, M-I-E-T-T-E, Miette's Bedtime Stories, in which she would read 30 minutes of some famous a short story writer, like 100 pieces. And I would climb into bed and let Miette, who had a lovely, I think it was a Scottish accent, but she had a lovely accent. I thought, this woman could actually get me to pay for this. Maybe not a lot of money, but she could get me to pay for this. So I was thinking, I love stories. I've been told that I have a really nice voice. And maybe I want to have a, not a Miette's bedtime stories, a Karen's bedtime stories, or a Karen's good morning story, or Karen's stories. But I don't have to write the story myself, which I would love to do at some point, but I can tell a story. I have a friend whose name is Miles White, and Miles was an entertainment reporter at the USA Today, and then he left the country. He teaches now in Korea. He just got married to a Slovakian woman, and he writes. And he, as he said, he credits USA Today with this because they were so succinct. He writes flash fiction, and he writes a series of books now that are called The Canvas Sextet. There are six series, and he said his stories are 250 words long. He writes 300 250-word stories and puts them in a one little book that he sells on Amazon. And they're wonderful. I've had a friend of mine who's a Michelle Slung, who is a very famous editor of mysteries in New York. She looked at him, and she was unimpressed. My friend Judy Bachrach, she was like, oh, some of them good, some of them are bad. And I just think they're wonderful because it's like if I were a chocoholic, that's the way I would approach these pieces. I mean, the first time he sent me one, I just read one right after the other until I looked up, and it was 11 o'clock at night. They're not all wonderful, but some of them are very clever and very interesting, and 250 words to get an atmosphere and a story in that kind of tight format is just amazing. And I thought to myself, well, here's something that's entirely different. Here's a new way of doing literature, and it's not some flash fiction I'm not impressed with because it doesn't seem to have themes, but his books actually have themes. One of them is called, one of the short stories is called Jesus Loves Me. Jesus Loves You, But Not Today. And it's about some kids who come into a high school to kill other people. It's just an amazing short story. And it's 250 words. Hello, goodbye, literally. And I gave it to my brother, who's an executive and travels around a lot. He said, I love these, because he's basically said, you know, I'm running through the airport. I've got to wait 5 minutes. It's just long enough to read one of these stories. So we have to sort of think in new ways. I hate the phrase think out of the box. You just have to sort of think, what am I interested in? And you've done, by being interested in radio, you're doing what you love. Now, you just have to figure out how to make it pay.
Yeah, I published my poetry anthology through Amazon to CreateSpace, and that's a terrific experience because the initial cost is only for the proof. Now it's
right.
The proof is $14.95 or whatever, and if you don't if you revise it, then you have to get another proof. If you don't, you just up there, and you can also then put it on a Kindle. And
mm-hmm.
and the problem is that you have to do all your own promotion. Now, of course, the mainstream publishing houses don't do any promotion unless just Stephen King or James Patterson, anyhow. So
right.
So many authors who are with mainstream publishing firms still have to do their own promotion the way my friend Kevin Buckley should have, I wasn't able to. So it's interesting. And you mentioned how I got started in the radio show. There's the woman named Maggie Mulvihill, who's a liberal activist, and she had a radio show. And
mm-hmm.
I went on there as the guest. And then I said, hey, I could do this. And just as you said, hey, I could do this. Then I was off and running. And then I've had some interesting people. And one of the people who's supposed to be on, but we keep missing each other because he's in France or he's going to Haiti, is Joel Dreyfus. So it's funny how all these names come together.
Yeah, but Joel's writing his, I think, an autobiography, or it's about his family and the connection of the Dreyfuses in Haiti, the black Dreyfuses, with the famous Dreyfus and the Dreyfus case. I think he might even be
France.
Right.
He and I have talked about that, yeah. That should be very interesting if he gets it out the door,
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think, it to me, I'm very grown up. That's another way of saying old compared to the millennials. But I think this is just a great, exciting period to be in, because you've got technology that you can utilize to help you get things out the door. There was some woman who, I guess she wrote an online science fiction or horror, I can't remember which, and then she got a huge contract from a traditional publishing company for it. But she was selling before, so the traditional publishing companies will follow your lead if you figure out a way to make things and make money and get the audience. And now we're universal. We have the opportunity to touch people all over the world. So it's not just people in the United States, whatever our population here is, but English speakers all over the world may be interested in something that you're doing, in a radio show that you're doing. And that
the famous story like that with the self-publishing, and the guy was actually selling books out of his trunk of his car, was something about a shack in the woods, or the little shack.
I actually bought it. I didn't find it very interesting, but, it made him money, so
it made him a lot of money.
What did you say?
It made him a lot of money, I said,
I mean, what was that, Jonathan Livingston Seagull? And that was done by a publisher, but, this is not heavy lifting. You just have to tap into what people really want. And then you can make money at it. Maybe you won't be Donald Trump multimillionaire. We don't really know how much money Donald Trump makes anyway. You can certainly make a living and enjoy yourself, because that is a great plus to whatever one is going to spend one's life doing. You like radio. So you have managed to put together a package of radio, poetry, writing, website that obviously makes you happier than if you were in a 9-to-5 job. And there's so many people. I just saw something today that came up on the internet. It was talking about 70% of people who work in their jobs would leave it if they could. Well, that's a very unhappy workforce. I mean, how are you going to get people to give their best and do their best if 70% of the workforce is not happy?
I used to tell my students at Monroe College that all they had to do, if they is to go down to either the Port Authority bus terminal, or to Wall Street, then Broadway, at 8:00 in the morning, and see people coming off the commutation with dead eyes, who obviously don't want to be where they're going.
Right.
And if you can't find something that you like, you're going to have 40 years of miserable income. You have to like what you're doing.
Well, I worked for Nightline, and it was a lot of sitting down, and I ended up having a piriformis problem. Initially, they thought I'd slipped a disc, but it turned out to be a piriformis. So, I had the health insurance included therapy, and I got to know the physical therapist that I went to for 6 weeks, and I said, "Who are most of your clients?" She was from Australia, and she said, "Most of my clients are Washington lawyers." She said, "Who hate their jobs, but they can't do anything about it. They can't quit. They got kids in private schools. They got a expensive house out in, the suburbs." And she said, "And it's all showing, all that negativity is showing up in their bodies." So my nephew, he loves to play music. My brother suggested he be an engineer. I told my nephew, I said, "Do what makes you happy, because you're going to be doing it for the next 40 years. And if it's music," and parents immediately say, "Oh, my God, you can't make any income in music." Yeah, but he'll be happy, and he'll make enough.
There's a great video on the internet that goes heavily into that. It's Steve Jobs' Stanford commencement speech from whenever I was, when he was still alive, and he tells that some great stories about that.
Yes.
I was going to get into Nightline. How did you get into television? How did you get with ABC?
Well, these things, I have to say, everything is always sort of serendipitous. A colleague of mine at the New York Times who'd worked for the Week in Review, and I cannot think of her name at the moment, ended up at Nightline as the, the writer who writes those first 5 minutes of the show. It's an editor's job. Anyway, she ended up going into the Clinton administration and being the ambassador to Belize. But before she left, she called me up. She was a Latina, and she said, "Hey, are you interested in going into television? They don't have any people of color over here, so I want to recommend some people of color." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm actually having a good time at the New York Times, but I am one of these people who always believes in having conversations. You know, you never know what will come out of a conversation." So I went over and I talked to the executive producer, Tom Batag, and to Ted at that time, and I said, you know, I have great admiration for Nightline, and I said, but I'm having a good time at the New York Times. It was the Clinton administration had just come in, and I was having a great time covering the Clinton administration. So I said, great admiration for you, but our stars just don't align right now. And they agreed, and that went away. Well, about 2 years later, they called me up and they said, we have a position for a producer, a senior producer over here. Would you be interested in having a conversation about that? And I said, yes, and that's what I did. I ended up going there because I thought, I'm 50 years old, and how often do you get an opportunity to go do something brand new and interesting? Now, I did learn in that I'm really not I'm not a group person, you know, team players. And television requires you, like, 30 people to get together and walk down a very narrow hallway all at the same time. But I did like what Ted did, and he is a past master at that. If I had been younger or had more chutzpah at that point, I would have loved to be an independent documentary producer. I did one piece there, and I really loved doing that. And Ted complimented me on the air for it. It was on a piece where they had digitalized interviews with formerly enslaved African Americans from the 30s and the 40s. Zora Neale Hurston and other famous anthropologists had interviewed these people, and they'd done it on 200-pound tape recorders, which they lugged up, and you could just imagine somebody getting out of a rickety car and up some backwoods place with this huge thing and saying, can you tell me about your life, sir or madam? And they digitalized them so that they no longer sound scratchy and popped and things like that. They sounded like somebody was sitting in the same room with you. So I did a piece on that, which was wonderful. And I would have loved to do those. And one of the pieces I actually suggested to Ted, which he decided he didn't want to do, there was a group of astrophysicists in Washington at the Smithsonian, and it was a conclave on whether science could prove there was God. And there was a famous theologian from England who was an astrophysicist and also in the clergy, and he gave a lecture in which he talked about all the things that would prove that God existed. And then there was a Jewish astrophysicist who was his friend who said, I'm going to give the shortest lecture ever. No, science does not prove there was God. But then he talked with great longing and great eloquence and poetic phrases about his longing. He said, you know, my relatives got killed in the Holocaust. And then he talked about how he would long to believe that there was something that was watching out for all of us. And I thought that that would have made a great Nightline for people, whether they believe in anything beyond that or not, that it would be one of those things that would have been riveting television to do that. And I had even thought of how to do it, but we didn't do it. because Ted said no, he didn't think that people would be interested. But I actually think people would have been interested in it. And if I had once again been thinking, I could have done it myself, just like you've done radio. There was a guy, I can't think of his name, who gave out the largest grants for people to look, investigate the nexus between religion or spirituality and science. He's dead now, but there were opportunities. I just wasn't thinking. I wasn't nimble enough thinking at the time. And there's still the possibility of doing that.
My son's a TV writer, and one of the things that he did, he was the executive producer of and the writer and the creator of of an ABC Family Channel miniseries, and he was very lucky. It was during the writer's strike, but it was being filmed in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't edit any of his own writing, but he was the executive producer, so he was getting paid. Yeah. So he was very lucky. They've also done a number of other things. So one of the things that jumped out at me, you did some speech writing. And how did you ever get hooked up with Queen Nora?
Queen Nora? Do you know, I don't remember
right.
who told me that. But actually, she wasn't happy with my speech. I did the speech.
All of a sudden, you blanked out on me. Are you having problems?
No. Can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
Oh, okay. Somebody called me and said she was looking for a speechwriter, and they recommended me because I've written speeches for corporate CEOs, for nonprofit CEOs. I don't write sort of templated speeches, and I like to make each speech different and unique to the person. And I read the speeches that she sent me, and they were very bland. And she wanted to talk about basically Jordanian women and Jordanian nonprofit women things and stuff like that. So I thought, I did talk to her about it. I said, well, really what you're talking about is love. And so I wrote a speech about that. She loved the first draft. But what often happens sometimes with people you write speeches for, if they've got enough friends, is they then run all of this speech by their friends. And since this was at Google, one of the things I had used in it was a virtual reality game. I can't remember it. Was it where you create everything? I can't remember the name of the game, but you create everything and the world grows with you. And I talked about how what she was doing with these women, not just in Jordan but around the world, was similar to this simulation kind of thing. Maybe it was called Sim. You know technology.
City and Sim. There was Sim City that grew into other Sim things, yeah.
Right, it was Sim City. And anyway, I used this as an example and a sort of a corollary or a metaphor for her things. And one of her friends said, well, you're going to be talking to people at Google. They already know about this kind of stuff. You don't want to be talking about stuff like simulation to people who already know about it. I was like, well, yeah, but anyway. So that's how I got that. But I got lots of other ones as well. That was one that didn't work out so well in the long run, but I did anyway.
You also mentioned college teaching. How did you ever get to Kansas State? I can see the Washington teaching, but how did you ever get to Kansas?
You know, I was at USA Today, and in my box was, I guess it was in other people's boxes, they were saying, they were looking for somebody to come teach there with a five-year fellowship. And I thought, well, I don't want to spend 5 years in Kansas, but, you know, let me just respond to them. And I did, and they flew me out, and I taught a class, and I interviewed with the staff. And I can't think of the woman who was the dean at the time. She had an interesting name. Anyway, I flew out, taught the class, and then came back, and she called up. Carol Okrup was her name. And Carol called me up, and she said, well, you're among our top three candidates, and what do you think of it? And I said, well, I enjoyed it. And I said, but I don't want to spend 5 years there. I would be happy to take the fellowship for a year, but, you know, and then you can offer it to somebody else for the other 4 years. But I don't know. And she told me, she said, well, you're one of our top three candidates. And then she was a wonderful down-to-earth woman. She said, oh, hell, Karen, you're our top candidate. If you want it, you come. I was like, yes, ma'am, I'll be there. So I took a leave of absence from USA Today and ended up teaching there for a year.
And did you enjoy it?
I loved it. It was perfect. I learned how to do the Texas two-step. I got my first pair of cowboy boots. Yes, indeed. I enjoyed it all. And I wrote poetry that actually got published. I wrote some poetry. I thought I was going to, every time I teach, I think to myself, I'm going to go and write a novel while I teach. And the reality is that if you're a teacher and you do your job, whether you do it good or bad, your students are going to suck up all your time. And they're going to be like little baby vampires. And it's not going to be just about what kind of work they're going to be doing. It's like, oh, my boyfriend broke up with me, or I can never get a girl to go out with me, or my parents are both lawyers. I don't want to be a lawyer. It's just all that kind of thing that goes on. It's being a counselor, and I love the students. I enjoy the students because it reminds me that no matter how old you are, you still have those same problems, love, health, what am I going to do kind of things. American University, Sandy Unger. Do you remember Sandy Unger from CBS?
Sandy Unger? Yes, yes.
And who's now the president of a university in Maryland. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, when Sandy became the dean at American University, they had had no people of color and no women on the journalism faculty. So that year that I worked, once again, I took a leave of absence from USA Today, which was very generous of them. Sandy had 7 women and 1 man that he hired that year, and I was there for a year as an adjunct professor. It was a great experience
and
as well.
Did you like that as well? Oh, you did?
Oh,
okay.
I loved it. I loved everything about it except going to faculty meetings. And Sandy would say to me, Karen, you've got to come to the faculty meeting. I'd say, Sandy, I will come to one faculty meeting, and if it becomes one of these things that lasts for hours, I won't come again. And the first and last faculty meeting that I went to, they had a 3-hour discussion about whether everybody should be done, I don't know, $15, $10 or something, so they could hire another assistant with the office. I told him afterwards, I said, Sandy, that was the last one I'm going to, because in 3 hours I could have written a freelance piece that would have paid for the assistant in the back rather than having all that discussion. But, yes, I love teaching it. I taught 2 classes in feature writing. And I had 13 students in the first class, and I was scared shitless. And they were all seniors, and they were sort of had that feeling of, you know, this is our last year. We're in great shape. And I jacked them up right away, and they were wonderful. Of the students, I required them all to basically do a freelance piece for a magazine, and one student got his piece published. He had been a junior rodeo champ. He got his piece published in a rodeo magazine. One of my students got her piece published in 17. It was about the death of a friend when you're 18 years old. Another young lady's family were Cuban Americans, and she got her piece published in a Latino magazine. So it was wonderful that out of 13 students, I think 5 of them got published and got paid. So much so, and it excited them so much that two of the students said, can we come talk to your new students so we can tell them how good this class is? And they did. They came and said, one of my students said, I don't write just for grades now. I write to be published, which I thought was interesting because it was the first piece she got published right away, but the second piece she did in draft. She didn't get that one published, but, you know, beginner's luck. So they were great. I love teaching.
Yeah, when I was at Monroe College and Monroe's campus in New York City is mainly minorities who were from neighborhoods that or families that didn't push education, and
right.
they were very bright, and they'd get out in the workforce and they'd say, hey, this isn't working out, I need an education, and they go to school, but they're working full time, and I never heard any. Will that be on the test? It's give me more than more. And I was able to get a whole bunch of them placed in IBM all over the country. And some of them had never thought that they'd ever work out in, outside of New York City, and they didn't have the aspirations. And I remember one young lady coming back from the recruitment down in Raleigh. And then I had them get up and tell the class the experience, and some got up and they said what a wonderful experience it was, whether they get hired or not. And this woman got up and said, I didn't go for the experience, I went to get a job. That she did.
She got it.
But it was just the great line. And some people told me that I, you know, you changed my life. And that's some of the best things I ever got out of all my Wall Street years or anything. It was a student saying, you changed my life.
Yeah, that's the joy of being a wonderful, of being a teacher. It's not the pay, it's not the hours, it's that you can affect people's life. I had one student I taught at Medill. They have a practicum in which they their graduate students from Northwestern's come and work, and I had a wonderful student. Her name is Emily D'Agostino. She writes beautiful, beautiful stuff now. And Emily, she's Italian, and she has short, curly hair, really short and tight. And I said to her, why do you wear your hair so short? And she said, well, it's kinky. I said, sweetie, I'm African-American. We're talking kinky. I said, you're not Versailles. You're a wild garden. Let your hair grow. And she did, but she was covering religion, and she didn't know who, he wrote Seven Story Mountain. Thomas
Merton.
Yeah, she didn't know who Thomas Merton was. She didn't know who all these people were, and she was writing a religion column because this is what the paper wanted her to write. She was going through a breakup with a boyfriend at the time, and it was just a terrible time for her. But she is just a stunning writer now. She's absolutely gorgeous, and it's her writing is informed with thoughtfulness and with research and reading. It's just wonderful, and I'm still in contact with her. She's just a wonderful, wonderful person.
You also mentioned to me that you're active in some political campaigns. Whose?
Yes, Michael Jackson, who ran for Prince George's County Executive Director. He's now a state legislator. Which was a really interesting experience, too, to be because Michael is a very soft-spoken candidate, and people said that they didn't think he would ever be able to engage people, but he did. You know, it's just a matter of focusing on it. I was watching a TED Talk the other day that, yes, it takes 100,000 hours to be a master at something, but it's the first 10 that really starts you up the track to going where you're going. And he did his 10 hours, and so obviously he's gone from being a candidate to being in office. That was a lot of fun.
You also worked for the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative organization, and you had started out with the New York Post, that was a liberal organization. How did you get involved
with AEI? Well, I freelanced
with
the American Enterprise Institute.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I remember there was a guy who asked me to come up and talk to his Howard students one time, and this was in a period of this. Howard is a historically black university. And the student said to me, how can you write for the Washington Post? And how can you write for the American Enterprise Institute? These are conservative publications. And I said, well, I have a big dog. I had a Great Dane, and I like to eat regularly. And as long as it doesn't conflict with my own values, I can write about anything. And I said, for American Enterprise Institute, I wrote about laser fusion, you know, which has nothing to do with politics.
Right. We have a caller who's been waiting for a while from your area code, too. Let me call the caller up and see what the caller has to say. The caller from the 703 area code, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
And who are you?
I'm Cindy. I have a quick question for you, Cindy Guidry. One of the things that I would like to know with Ms. DeWitt, she talked about writing novels, and she gave the description of the one person who read their novels, which she considered doing that with her novel.
Huh. Would I consider reading whatever I've written? I hadn't thought about it, but it's a good idea. maybe I could get some people to respond.
What's stopping you from moving forward on this?
Oh, I have so many other things to do. Actually, I think there's a famous Yodo quote. It's either do or don't do, but don't try.
Right.
So,
there is no try from
there
Yoda,
is no
yeah.
try. And there's also the same thing in, what is it, the Kung Fu Panda. His guy also says the same thing, something similar. The turtle who is the guru to everybody sort of suggests the same thing. Do or don't do, there is no try. So I guess I haven't thought about it, but you gave me an idea, and maybe I will do it.
All right. Thank you for taking
Cindy.
My call.
Okay. Do you have anything else for Karen, Cindy?
One more question, if I may. If Karen could highlight a bit more in terms of working that campaign, would she do that again for a candidate?
Nah. I'm sorry. I had the experience. No, I don't really. I'm not really a team person, and working on a campaign really is a team kind of effort. And I'm glad I did it, but it was a lot of work. And basically you're responsible for somebody else. I have a hard enough time being responsible for me. But people can make a fortune working on campaigns. It's just not something I want to do.
James Carville. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Oh,
I really
another...
enjoyed the talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have another caller from the 303 area code. Caller, you're on the line. Who are you?
Hey, John and Karen. It's Laurie and Pratt. How are you?
Hi, Laurie. How are you?
Hi.
Hello,
I'm great.
Laurie.
Hey, I love this interview. What a fantastic and rich and varied career you've had, and I just really appreciate you guys taking the time to do this. My question for you has to do with some of the things you said about the future of media. As John knows, I'm sort of passionate about the visual side of things. And I wonder if you could comment, as we look at Facebook and a lot of this new media, we seem to be, you know, not kind of moving beyond text and words. I think the text and words are still there. But we do seem to have, you know, more pictures and more interactive stuff. And the New York Times even had this little interactive tool where you had to guess the relationship between two variables about a month back. And I just wonder, Karen, if you could comment on the future of kind of the visual side of media.
Well, I don't know if you were on when I was talking about my friend Miles White and his Canvas Sextet flash fiction or not, but I just
yes.
was talking to him the other day, and he said that one of the things he wants to do is to do a video of one of the stories. I don't know how he's going to do it. I don't think he means I'm going to make a mini movie. But I think that's a great idea. I mean, as I told him, he said it was a vanity project for him, and I said it may be vanity, but it's also smart marketing, particularly for millennials who like visuals. I said it may actually suck them into reading your piece once they see the little miniature visual. I think it depends on what you want to do with it. I mean, and I'm not just talking about little mini movies, but graphic ways of doing things. I saw one recently that I just thought was splendid. It was like cutouts and animation to show a science project or a science story. I think it depends on what you want to do. Tell me what something that you want to do with it that you yourself
well,
think about.
I guess I'd really like to explain really complex interactions like virtuous cycles and vicious cycles. So, you know, what were we talking about last week, John, that is as wages go up, people's ability to spend goes up, and then that helps businesses, and then that makes wages go up. And it seems to me that we have more and more of these kind of multi-link things. And
right.
I just guess I'm wondering, as you tell stories and you kind of hit this complexity barrier, just if you could talk about that, and you know, is it more than just eye candy? I mean, do we really need you know, this kind of new visual thing to explain worlds, things in a more complex world. That's my hypothesis, but I don't know if I'm right, and I'd really like to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, a picture is worth a thousand words, and so I absolutely agree with you, and particularly for complex things. For example, I mean, I'm just going to use this as an example. I don't want to go deep into it, but, I mean, the momentum that Donald Trump is getting is based on what? What? I mean, it's not truth. There's no facts for any of these things. I mean, talking about immigrants being rapists and drug dealers when the reality, I think it's very hard for most people are what I think are engaged in what I call bread and baby issues, my family and making a living.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have time to read deeply. It's not that they're not smart. They just don't have the time for it. I mean, the earlier caller asked why I hadn't thought about reading the novel that I'm writing. You know, I just hadn't thought about it, and I just hadn't done it. Why hadn't I finished the novel? Because it's either you do or you don't do. But I think that if you could explain complex things to an audience, you could become that newspaper radio thingy. It's because it's not going to be a newspaper or a radio or a magazine. It's going to be a visual explanation for something that seems very complex. I will, once again, let me go back to that story I was telling about these astrophysicists. There was an astrophysicist who explained the Big Bang by using a huge graphic of a Campbell's soup can. And it was amazing. I got it. I mean, I can't explain it now, but I got it. He explained it, and it was hysterical. The audience was mostly astrophysicists. It was all scientifically based, and it was wonderful. And I, who don't know squat about science, was intrigued enough that I wanted to go back and do this Nightline piece on, you know, science and religion. So I think, once again, if you can do it, I think there'll be people who want to see it. There's the guys who do the NPR thing. They did the thing on money, on the falling apart of the bubble.
Right.
If you can do that visually, I think you have a potential for a much larger audience than people who read.
The critical sound bite sizes, would it just be the equivalent of 250 words, 500 words, just something that they could grasp very rapidly?
I think you have to try it and see.
There is a wonderful public health from Sweden, Hans Rosling, and called Gapminder that produces these wonderful tools. But his TED videos, if you haven't seen his TED videos, he has one video where he explains technology and what's happened through the washing machine that was brought into his house, and his grandmother had to see it, and on about this washing machine. And he was saying, but the most important part of the washing machine was what it produced. He opens the door, and it was books, that his mother had the time now to read books to him. And it was just a terrific about how technology moves in other directions as they go. But his stuff is just wonderful. Karen, I don't know whether you heard last week's show, but Lauren was the guest, and Lauren explains complex issues through products that she's developed. And coincidentally, you mentioned the Carter election. One of the things that she's done is for the Carter Center, analyzing justice programs in Liberia, and so she takes on big things, and it sounds though that she's also looking to simpler ways to explain big things. Is that accurate, Lauren?
Yeah, I think just because it's complex in the background doesn't mean it has to be complex in the presentation.
Yeah,
and
I agree with you, absolutely.
We often fall for this fallacy that if it's easy to understand, therefore it must not be sophisticated. And so I know a lot of scientists, and you probably ran into this too, that will kind of obfuscate on purpose for reasons of being impressive. And I think we need to move past that, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think you just need a, what do they call them? Somebody was telling me they wanted to go kayaking, and she's going to join a, I can't think of what they're called. This is what happens at certain age. Groups that want to go kayaking. It's not like dating. I think you just need a group of people to sit around and bounce ideas off and think about how you can do it.
Well, thank you again. I really appreciate your thoughts, and it's been a great interview. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I'm going to tune in and look at yours. I'm sure it's archived. Or listen
Thanks,
to yours.
Guys. Yeah, that'd
thank
be great.
You.
Thank
and drop me a line, too. Okay,
I
bye.
Will.
Bye.
Thank you, Lorian. The it was a very good interview. The last time we did get into her background, and we also got into these complex problems and the approach to it. She was terrific. What's next for Karen DeWitt?
Well, actually, I have an idea for an internet business, and I'm not going to say anything because I'll just send you the link when it's launching. I got, you know, thegrid.io?
Thegrid.io? I'm not sure.
It's supposed to be, what do they call it? What is AI called?
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it's a new website, and I'm one of the, quote, founding members. And by founding members, it means I've paid for a year's use of this. And they've got like 59,000 members, and they've let the first 10,000 in the beta. So I'm waiting to get on that. I'm in the 20,000 range. But I want to do more writing. I want to have more fun in life. I'm taking a swimming course. I'm going to Cuba in December, working on my Spanish again. And I want to get this internet project, this internet business launched and see what happens and wait for the next chapter in life. What about you, John? You sound like you've got a lot going.
I'm teaching at Sony Purchase. I have the weekly column. I have the radio show, and I'm doing some consulting back on Wall Street where I was 20 years ago. You also mentioned that you're into to meditation. How did you make that transition?
Oh God, years ago. It's just really helpful. 20 minutes. I've got a little app from the Insight Meditation people. And actually, I can look it up and tell you how long I have been meditating now. In my latest iteration, I started meditating back in my early 40s. And I started again, and I can tell you how many days, because of this neat little app, how long I have been doing this.
Wow.
I have, where are my numbers? My milestones. My statistics, days with at least, I have meditated for 659 days.
Okay, that's 2 years.
Yeah, every day for 30 minutes.
Wow. We've touched a lot of bases tonight. What else would you like our audience to know about you?
I hope to live healthy for the next 20 years, and that means I'm going to have to lose some weight. That's about it. I wish for my country to be at peace and to be all that I know that the United States could be. We have so much talent here, and so much talent. Our real treasure is squandered because we don't spend time on education. I remember years ago reading about people who retired to Arizona, and they didn't want to raise taxes for schools because they were all retirees, and yet you have a whole group of new American kids, and you want those kids well-educated. I grew up Catholic, and I remember at the time there was a big push among Catholics, like, oh, we pay for schools. Why should we pay property taxes for everyone else? Well, I don't have any kids at all. I've got a lot of godchildren, but my whole feeling is I want to pay taxes because I want kids educated so that I don't get mugged as an old lady. And that's what everybody else should be wanting to do, too. I want health care for everyone. Bugs don't know whether you make $500,000 or you make $50. And we are making super bugs now because people aren't taken care of. We've got super pneumonia now out there. And that's not going to make any difference whether you're rich or poor if that gets out into the general population. I would like my country to be happy again as much as possible. That's what I'd like.
Yeah, they used to gall me when I'd hear people say that they were voting against the school budget here because they didn't have kids in the school anymore. Well, other people paid for their kids.
Right.
So it was time for them to pay for other kids. And I really think that the internet and gerrymandering and the whole political situation has turned us into an angry country. And the thing that scares me about all of the new media is I remember reading that only something like 4% of the people to watch Sean Hannity are liberal, and only 6% of the people to watch Rachel Maddow are conservative. People only now to look at things or they read things that they know they agree with, and they just get more and more locked into positions. Then the other people then become the bad guys rather than people with a different point of view, and it concerns me. You mentioned Donald Trump. Donald Trump is the epitome of this. He yells at everyone. He doesn't like anyone. He's the nasty son of a bitch, and he's the leading candidate in the Republican Party. that
it worries me as well. And as a matter of fact, in 1999, I was asked to write a piece for the Nieman magazine at Harvard on where the internet was going, and I said, "You look at the past to see where the future is going, and what was going to happen was I thought we'd end up having little niches where people would only watch what they wanted to watch or listen to what they wanted to listen, and that's exactly where we are. And then who's going to tell the real deal to people on either side? Who's going to really say what's going on for most of us? And as a nation that's got more guns than any place and ought to be, I worry that all those angry people, and we are an angry nation at this particular point, will do angry things with their with the guns. That's worrisome.
DeLorean, who is just on the show, is moving toward bigger and bigger things. One I've heard her is if we could agree on what the problems are, and she thinks that you can do this through an approach to technology that lets people agree on things who can wind up solving problems. And she feels that the young people who are in from a very early age into video games and to education by technology, they will solve these problems for us, that they will be the educated future that we don't have now. Now, I hope she's right.
As they would say in Arabic, inshallah, God willing.
God willing. Thank you very much, Karen. It's been a real
pleasure. Thank you, John. And when I get ready to launch this new product, which I think also has something to do with society, I'll let you know.
Okay.
And you've got a listener from now on. Thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right.
A bit of commercial information. My column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Pipes. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at johnmack13.johnmackrants.com, and that's JohnMacRants. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, then we're still in first place. Put it in a book. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for the URLs of previous shows and the schedules of upcoming shows. Tune in next week, and until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya.
See ya. Thank you.